I'm Hans.
And I am Franz, and we just want to pop
your insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, hour three has begun officially, so let's make the most of it. 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I've got a quick report here I want to share with you before we go to the phones. This is from National Catholic Register. Students for Life has released a report featuring Catholic schools around the country with ties to Planned Parenthood. When Catholic institutions of higher learning publicly associate with Planned Parenthood, despite the Catholic Church's clear teaching on the grave evil of abortion, faithful students and alumni should take note. A recent report from Students for Life can help you do just that. The group investigated 784 Christian institutions, meaning Christian in a general sense, many of them Protestant schools. And this included 237 Catholic schools, and it found, initially, that 103 Protestant schools and 22 Catholic schools were connected with Planned Parenthood. The report was released last month investigating the websites of these different schools over the fall of 2021 and identified relationships to Planned Parenthood that included promoting the organization as an internship opportunity for credit, promoting Planned Parenthood as a student resource, advertising or partnering on a Planned Parenthood event from 2019 onward, and promoting the group as a volunteer or career opportunity. Talk about a career opportunity. Hey, you get to make money while you kill people. Schools with ties to Planned Parenthood were emailed and even called by phone in September and October of 2021 prior to the report's release, giving them an opportunity to remove references to Planned Parenthood. Lauren Enriquez, deputy media strategist with Students for Life, told the Register that the report was meant to hold these schools accountable to the students that go there, the alumni, especially if they're donors, and parents who are going to be paying for their kids' tuition to go to these schools. According to their latest annual report, Planned Parenthood performed, get this, 354,871 abortions just in the past year. So the wanton killing of innocent human lives to the tune of nearly 355,000 people gone. The seven Catholic schools that were found to still have links to the big abortion provider, Planned Parenthood, on their websites were, and they don't deserve a drum roll, St. Michael's College in Vermont, Sacred Heart University of Connecticut, the College of St. John Fisher in New York, Marymount University in Virginia, the College of St. Rose in New York, St. Joseph's University in Pennsylvania, and Felician University in New Jersey. None of these schools would return requests for comments on the report's finding. Another school listed at the time of the report's release, Trinity Washington University in D.C., had a link to Planned Parenthood as a women's health resource, according to screenshots from the report, but the link is no longer publicly visible and it requires you to log in. It's still there, apparently, but you've got to log in order to see it. They, too, did not return any requests for comment. The college has received letter grades in the report based on how many times the school's website referenced Planned Parenthood. St. Michael's College of Vermont earned the lowest grade, an F, among Catholic schools in the report, as it listed Planned Parenthood as a resource on five separate occasions, under student health services, including contraception, dating and relationships, and men's health. Among the schools that earned a D rating were Marymount University, which lists Planned Parenthood as a resource for a web design class and two social media classes. Also getting D's, Sacred Heart University of Connecticut. Who else do we have? St. John Fisher College of New York, D. College of St. Rose in New York got a C rating because of fewer references to Planned Parenthood. The report found that 14 of the 22 Catholic schools the group contacted severed their connection to the organization, that being Planned Parenthood, after being informed of it. Catholic schools that removed their website links to Planned Parenthood included Fordham University in New York, Georgetown in D.C., and a few others. So parents, I mean, this is definitely worth your while to take a look at, because if you're considering sending a son or daughter to college at one of these schools or other schools for that matter, you would do well and you would be wise to investigate to what extent some of these ostensibly Catholic colleges and universities may be in cahoots with big abortion. And would you really want to spend your hard-earned money on tuition at a school where the kids are being swayed in the direction of seeing Planned Parenthood as a viable resource? Anyway, we have schools that are friends of Relevant Radio. I'm thinking, for example, of Christendom College, University of Mary. There are others. So by all means, if you're interested in some Catholic colleges and universities that we recommend, you can always go to relevantradio.com and take a look at some of our sponsors. If you haven't had a chance to visit Christendom College's beautiful campus on the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, any time of year is a beautiful time of year to go there. Let's go to Allie in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Allie.
Hi, Patrick. I just want to keep this short and sweet. I am interested in learning about why Catholics don't believe in the rapture. And my family and I have had a lot of conversations about it, and we're just really not sure what to think of it based on some, you know, biblical scriptures about it. And I just wanted to hear your take on it.
Sure, be happy to. So the rapture is a biblical teaching, and you can read all about it in First Thessalonians chapter 4, where it describes who those who are alive when the Lord returns will be raptured into the heavens and caught up into the air, it says. The word rapture itself actually comes from how St. Jerome translated that passage from the biblical Greek into Latin. And he chose the word in Latin, rapere, which is the word, actually in the subjunctive, it's rapiemur. Actually, it wouldn't even be subjunctive, wouldn't it? It would be the... I'll have to stop and think about the part of speech that it is. But rapiemur is, so it's the passive voice that he chose there. It means to be caught up. We get the word rape from that same root word, snatched away, caught up, grabbed away. Rapture is where that word comes from. I should say the word rapiemur is where the word rapture comes from. And it's described in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. The problem here is that in the Protestant world, there has grown up this unbiblical, I would argue even anti-biblical notion that there will be a rapture of God's people, however people want to define that, before the tribulation. So there are different versions of the rapture theory. The most common one, the Left Behind books, for example, they promote this notion of a pre-tribulation rapture. That is not biblical. That will not happen before the time of the tribulation. There will be a rapture, and that'll be at the very end, but that's not what the rapture people are saying when they talk about the rapture. So if you'd like a book, I would recommend a book called Will Catholics Be Left Behind by Carl Olson, published by Ignatius Press. And that is a book-length treatment of the topic. It goes meticulously through all of the arguments, all of the Bible verses, all of the claims that are made about the rapture, and it just systematically debunks them to show that this idea of a pre-tribulation rapture is simply not true.
Okay, perfect. Right. I'm glad you mentioned the Left Behind books, just because that's how a lot of the conversations come up from, you know, based on what it says in those books. So thank you. I will take a look at that book, and I love your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Allie. Thank you. Yeah, I think the book will be very helpful to you and anyone else that you're sharing this issue with. So again, the book is called Will Catholics Be Left Behind? And the author is Carl Olson. Let's go now to Valentina in Easton, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Valentina.
Hi, good morning. I just have a quick question. Mm-hmm. I'm doing the first Friday Sacred Heart devotion.
Right.
And this would be, tomorrow would be my sixth one. But I'm sick. I feel good, but I feel I'm still, I guess, within the, I have coronavirus in the 10 days of the thing, the isolation or whatever.
Yeah.
So I guess I was wondering like where that leaves me. Like, can I just do it like when I'm better, like next Friday in Canada is my sixth, or do I have to like wait until February and count that as my sixth? I don't want to miss it. I just feel, I don't know what to do because I feel like totally better. And, but I don't want to like, I don't know what to do. So, and I don't know where it counts or like what I should count it as or not count it as. Or
yeah. So people may have different opinions on this, but here's mine. I think the way this is promised by the Lord to St. Margaret Mary Alacoque is that you have to go 9 consecutive First Fridays. So yeah. I don't think you can substitute. So I, okay. Unfortunately, you know, it would mean either finding a priest who would be willing to celebrate Mass, and you could, you know, you could be, maybe you could receive communion if you'd be willing to do that. I mean, it's a long shot perhaps, but you could look into that and see if that's possible. But my general sense is that if you miss a Friday, you start over and you start counting from the next First Friday forward. And I don't think that the devotion permits, I know it doesn't say anything about you can substitute this Friday or that Friday. I think they have to be consecutive Fridays.
Okay. I didn't know if there was like 6 dispensations or.
Well, remember it's a remember it's a private devotion, so it's part of private revelation. You're not obligated to follow it. I think it's a good thing, and the church is wise to promote it. But it's not as though, you know, you can derive no benefit from it. So if you went to Mass the following First Friday, or the following Friday for that matter, that's all good. I mean, spiritually beneficial to you. But to fulfill the specific promise that's attached to it, to go to Mass, receive communion, go to confession on the consecutive 9 Fridays, First Fridays, I think that part is integral to it. So I guess you could just say, well, Lord, I didn't make it this time, but help me make it next time. And
it's not that I don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like, I guess, if I'm on like day 8 of quarantine, like am I even, I don't even know if I could go or am I allowed to go or what. I don't even know.
What is the current advice from the medical profession? Because I think it used to be 15 days and then I think it might have been reduced to, I don't know, to something
less
than that.
Well, now I heard 5.
Yeah, maybe 5.
I heard it's like, it's like if you're 20, at least 24 hours without a fever, which now I'm like 3 days without a fever, and your symptoms improved, and I'm on 3 days of symptom improvement. I mean, I'm almost 100%. So I'm like, I feel like I could go.
I would go to the CDC website and just see what is the current, what is the current standard? Is it 5 days after the last sign of any symptoms? It may be that now. And if it is, then great. Then there's your answer. Then you can go. If you're still within what the medical profession says is the time of danger, then I think it would be smart to, you know, to not put anyone else at risk. But if it's at all possible to go.
And that was the question. Right, because it was 10, and then I think they changed it to 5. And to, like, I'm on, like, day 8 or 7 or whatever.
Yeah.
And my son's on day, like, 9.
Well, if that's the case, I mean, if that's in fact what the new standard is, then it sounds like you're in the clear.
Okay, great. Awesome.
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Well, pray for me, please, when you get to Mass. I'd sure appreciate that. Thank you so much. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Rhonda now in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Rhonda.
Hello. My question is the Bible was, all of the Bible was inspired by God. So why are the 4 Gospels by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, 2 of which were disciples, 2 were not, why wouldn't it be Matthew, John, Peter, and Paul, the 4 people that were directly associated with Jesus?
Okay. Well, St. Luke was not even a disciple, so he was not a follower of Jesus. He was an apostolic writer, but he wasn't one of the disciples, certainly wasn't one of the 12 apostles, nor was Mark, it seems, also. They were. They came later. But if you consider, let's just take St. Mark's gospel as an example. St. Mark received his gospel more or less directly from St. Peter. And he spent a lot of time with St. Peter, including when St. Peter was in captivity. And so it seems that St. Peter related to St. Mark all those specific details that go into St. Mark's gospel. One interesting thing about that, Rhonda, is you'll notice that all the great things about St. Peter, you know, he's given the keys of the kingdom and he's told, you know, feed my sheep and all the other things that were really important about St. Peter and his role are completely absent in Mark's gospel. And all of the negative things about St. Peter are found in Mark's gospel. So it's a sort of internal bit of evidence that suggests that St. Peter, when conveying the gospel to St. Mark, he really did not try to put himself in a super good light. He emphasized the negatives and he didn't really get into some of the superlatives, which I think speaks to his humility. But it was St. Mark who was inspired by the Holy Spirit to write that. He received the data from St. Peter, but the Holy Spirit inspired him to write what he wrote. Now, in the case of St. Luke, if you look at chapter 1, verse 1, you'll see that he explains this very phenomenon. He says that I have decided, after investigating all of the different testimonies about Jesus, to set them down in an orderly chronological fashion so that you can understand the story of Jesus and also to understand that what you were told by the eyewitnesses is true. But I'm going to put it down in an orderly format so that you can read kind of from beginning to end. And so what St. Luke tells us is that he canvassed who knows how many people who were eyewitnesses of the Lord. So he talked to them, he sat down with them, he wrote down what they told him. Almost certainly one of those people was the Blessed Virgin Mary, because in St. Luke's gospel, we have certain details about the life of Our Lady that nobody could know if she hadn't explained it, you know, like the Annunciation and other things like that. So these are the accounts of the life of Jesus that come in some cases directly from the apostles, but they were received and elaborated upon and written down in the case of Mark and Luke by two men who were not apostles. But the roots of what they wrote down did indeed come from the apostles.
Okay. And your answer was fantastic. Thank you. That makes it so much, it gives me another reason to look at, to read it and look at it in a different light. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you. Great chatting with you. Let's go now to Edith in Bakersfield. Good morning, Edith.
Good morning. I'm calling to get some advice on how to answer some comments made to me by my sister.
Okay.
She's currently disabled due to health issues and has been on a lot of medications. She also suffered 30 years in an emotionally abusive marriage. About 10 years ago, she lost her 24-year-old son in a very tragic accident. But now she says that she sees him and communicates with him. And I told her that she needs to let him rest and just pray for his soul. Mm-hmm. They visited us during Thanksgiving along with her daughters. And one daughter shared that she sees a psychic. And I told my niece that that was a dangerous thing because, you know, it opens up the door to evil things. Mm-hmm. But then she said that she only sees psychics of the light and not of the dark. And then my sister found out that about my conversation with my niece, and she emailed me this week saying that that she supports my niece 100%, and that that the psychic she sees communicates with heaven. And then she also said that my sister, that she also too communicates with heaven, and she was in dismay when I told her about letting my nephew rest. She says that she enjoys communicating with him and communicates with angels on her behalf. And then she says that this has brought her happiness. And then she recommended for me to read a book by Robert J. Grant. It's called Edgar Cayce on
Edgar
Angels.
Casey.
Casey, okay. On Angels, Archangels, and Unforeseen Forces. And then she went on to say that everyone will go to heaven, but people with mortal sins will get punished in a different way, and that she couldn't say, kind of like alluding to saying that she knew. She also says that she believes in reincarnation and that purgatory and the devil are not real.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past,
I can
she
help
also
you.
Share that, you know, she... Okay, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, the first thing is she's barking up the wrong tree, because if she believes that she's communicating with her deceased son, I guess, almost certainly she's not. Because God can permit that, and at times he does permit that, but only and always for a holy reason. So all these other things that are swirling around are really clear markers that this is not a holy situation. This is not something that God is causing to happen. So when these entities, let's say, appear or they presume to give messages or purport to give messages, things like that, almost always it's going to be an evil spirit. Very rarely would it be somebody who's actually the person himself. And even there have been some instances where great saints have been visited by what appear to be Jesus or appear to be Mary or some, you know, saint of old. And there's just something not quite right. Excuse me. Frog in my throat. Something not quite right that's unsettling to the saint. And so in some cases, you hear stories of where the next time this entity appears, appearing to be Jesus or something, you know, when the saint would throw holy water at it, it would become clear that this was a demon. So I think you're absolutely right to advise her the way you have. Edgar Cayce is definitely not a trustworthy source. He was some kind of a clairvoyant. He was known for falling into a trance, and while he was in his trances, he would dictate these fantastical predictions and other things. Some of them were eerily accurate. So I don't know what to make of him, but he certainly wasn't a Catholic. He wasn't speaking for God. He was a clairvoyant guy. And so I would not put any stock in him in any authoritative way. Interesting, yeah, but nothing more than that. And he may well have also been influenced by demons. So your approach to the topic is, in my view at least, it's on target. Is it possible that somebody is seeing the actual person who has died? It's possible. But I think you, in this situation, can reasonably rule that out as a possibility, just given all the other things that are contrary to the will of God that are part of this. So that would be my approach. I think your reaction to it is the right one.
Okay. Anything that I can give her or suggest, or other than what I've done already, I don't know. I need to kind of respond. I haven't responded back to her email. I just been praying about it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got to take a break. Forgive me, Edith. Let me see if I can't think of something during the break. And if I can, I'll mention it on the other side. Do keep listening, though, and I thank you for the call. I'll be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Well, I was trying to think about a good resource for people who think that they see the dead or think that they're going to gain something valuable by going to a tarot card reader or some other thing like that. Those are all things you should stay far away from, obviously. But I wasn't really successful in coming up with anything unique, so I'll just fall back on a couple of books that I've recommended before. They're not directly on this topic, but they do deal with the issue of communication with spirits, and that is the book on hell. So The Dogma of Hell by Father F.X. Schuppe, S-C-H-O-U-P-P-E. It's got a lot of stories in there, and not just stories like fables. These are documented examples of where God would permit the souls of the damned to come back and warn people. It does happen, by God's permission anyway. And that would be a good book to read. That might scare somebody in the right direction to realize that the devil certainly would like to pantomime and counterfeit some of those signs that God actually really does perform, but the devil can only pantomime them. That'd be one book. The other book by the same author is called Purgatory. And it is a longer book, but it goes through many, many examples of documented stories of the souls of those who are in purgatory manifesting to warn people, including to warn them about things like seances and tarot cards and palm reading and stuff like that. So if somebody's interested in real life examples of spirits communicating information to people in this life, I would read those books. And who knows, maybe that will help dislodge these silly notions from the minds of the people who are dabbling in them. I remember over the years, I'll just put this out there. Over the years, I've been doing a lot of public speaking now for 35 plus years. And on any number of occasions, it hasn't happened in a long time, but it's happened, where typically it would be a woman would come up to me and she'd say, I can see your aura. And at first, the first time it was told to me, I didn't know what it meant. Like, well, what do you mean by that? I can see the colors that are glowing around you. And I can see your guardian angel. And I can see that God is very happy with you and things of that nature. And after the first time, I thought, well, that's just kind of odd. And then maybe several more times, and I remember one time there was two women who came up to me and said, we can see your aura. And we can see all the spiritual things. And I realized at this point, you don't see anything. This is in your mind. This is in your imagination. And there are people out there who, in their own imaginations, they have convinced themselves that they are mystical and that they see things like that, when in fact they really don't. Now, the alternative, there are really only two. The far more likely alternative to it being all in your imagination is that, yeah, you're seeing something, but it's coming from the devil. In which case, you should run. Far less likely, but still possible, would be that, yeah, okay, you may be seeing something, and you happen to be St. Padre Pio, and it's God that's showing you this, or your guardian angel. That's possible, too. But in the course of human history, that is statistically far less, it happens far less often than demonic interference or just somebody's own overactive imagination. So I'm not saying God couldn't be doing it, but I'm almost certain that he's not doing it. All these other things that are involved are good indicators that these kinds of things are not from God.
Could it be Satan?
You know what's weird about that, Cyrus, is that people under the age of about
40,
50, 45 would have no idea what that is or where that's from.
I know it. So
yeah, but you're like in your, you know,
70s.
You have days where you feel like that?
Sometimes.
No, but seriously, I would say probably nobody 40 and under would have any clue what that was or where it came from.
Are you telling me to scratch it?
No. No. Let's keep them on their
good.
Toes, right?
Yeah,
let's
like
keep
it.
Them on their toes. All right.
Well, isn't that special?
Yeah. All right. You've got a million of those, don't you? Let's go to Tricia in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Tricia.
Good morning, Patrick. I just have three questions about the Latin Mass. I went for the first time last Sunday, and it was the most holy, reverent Mass I've been to. Well, I'm 60, so I probably attended one or two when I was maybe two or three.
Okay.
And I just returned back to the Catholic Church last year, and my husband actually became Catholic with me, even though
Wonderful.
We were married in the Catholic Church. Yes, it's been quite a blessing. We've been praying our rosary. I've been doing the Divine Mercy. So my question was, during Mass, there was a seminarian there, and he wore the garment that just goes around the shoulders, which they usually use to hold where Jesus is. The monstrous, is it called?
Mm-hmm. It's probably a cope. They call it a cope. And it's
okay.
A large, stylized, sort of almost like a cape that wraps
yes.
over the shoulders. Okay. So if that's what that was, okay.
Okay. And as they were preparing communion, and of course they were facing Jesus, he seemed to have his hand over his eyes with this cope. Is that what he was doing?
Say that again.
His
he
arm
had his
was
hand
up.
Over what now?
Over his eyes. Like, it was brought up to his face with the cope, and it looked like he was covering his eye, the seminarian. And we thought maybe because he was not fully a priest yet, he was not able to look upon the host, but I wasn't sure what that was. Or was he?
I'm not sure. And you know what? I would not be the right person to try to venture a guess on these issues. If your
okay.
questions are about things like this, let me refer you to a good Catholic priest. His name is Father John Zulsdorf, and he goes by Father Z online. And okay. His, if right. you have a, if you have a pen handy, I'm going to give you his website address.
I do.
Okay, so his blog used to be called "What Does the Prayer Really Say," but it just goes by Father Z's blog now. But the first letters of each of those words is the address for the website. So it's wdtprs.com. wdtprs.com. And what that stands for is "What Does the Prayer Really Say?" And if you go there, first of all, he's a liturgical expert, and he has a lot of insight on these issues. You may be able to find an article he's already written about such things, but if you don't, and there is a search bar there, you could actually send him a note on the website and ask him these specific questions, and I wouldn't be surprised if he gave you an answer on his website.
That would be great, because I had two or three others because I had been away for so long, and we'd like to go back, which we definitely will, because I love the fact that we had communion on the tongue, which even my husband, who was a Lutheran and who did become Catholic, never felt it was right receiving it in the hand. But we didn't know where else to go until we found this one. It's about 40 minutes away, this church. So anyway, I will contact him. Thank you for your help.
You're most welcome. Thank you. And tell him I said hello. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Luis in California. Hi, Luis.
Hi. Sorry about that. So my other question is, so I was reading the Old Testament, and I was in Maccabees already, and I think it's chapter 2, verse 1, book of Maccabees.
First book, okay.
Yes. So, and there, it talks about, like, how, you know, it talks about Daniel, when he was going to be eaten by the lions, mm-hmm. and also by the, I think it's verse 59 to 60.
Okay.
And that's my only question, because it talks about Daniel, and then I still need to read like 13 books to get to Daniel, and that's like way back. So I don't know how come it's talking about Daniel when I don't know if it already happened. But I mean, the books are Daniel is in front of Maccabees, so I don't know what to make out of it.
I must say I'm not sure what the question is. Could you restate that for me? Because I want to make sure I understand what you're asking.
So my question is, like, how come in Maccabees is talking about Daniel
okay.
when there's still, like, 13 books ahead of Maccabees?
Oh, okay. If I understand you correctly. Okay, so in the book of Daniel, we read the story about Daniel in the lion's den. So that's the topic,
yes.
right? When Daniel, okay, and he was miraculously saved from being eaten by
yes.
the lions. Okay, so that's
yes.
in Daniel. So the book of Maccabees, which was written long after that, long after that, it's referring back to that. In other words, it's talking about something that had happened in the past.
Oh, but how come Maccabees is like behind, and then Daniel is like in front of Maccabees?
That's well, I don't know what you mean by behind and in front of, but I mean, the book of Daniel comes earlier chronologically in salvation history than the book of Maccabees. So the first and second Maccabees were written not long before the time of Jesus. So within roughly 100 years or so of the time of Jesus. And I'd have to go back and research this to see exactly how long, but it was relatively close to the time of Jesus.
Oh, okay, because I'm reading the, you know, the Old Testament by the, like, Genesis to all the mm-hmm. way to Maccabees right now. But I still need to read 13 books to get to Daniel. So I'm reading
okay.
Maccabees right now, and so I don't know how that's possible.
Well, I don't know what Bible you're looking at, but if you're reading a Catholic Bible, First and Second Maccabees, I believe, are the very last books of the Old Testament before you get to the New Testament. So I don't know why they would be placed before Daniel in the biblical canon of the Old Testament, but let me recommend a couple of resources that can help you. One is a book called A Guide to the Bible by Father, what's his name? He has since died, but it's published by Ignatius Press. His mind just went out of my brain. Very good book, and it goes book by book through the Holy Bible. Every single book has a brief chapter on it. And in it, he gives you the author of the book, or authors as the case may be, when it was written, who it was written for, what is it about, what's the basic plot. And it's Father Ken, what's his name? It's going to torture me now. But if you go to Ignatius.com or go to your local Catholic bookstore and you want to find A Guide to the Bible, Father Ken, and the last name is just escaping me. But anyway, that would be a really good resource, and that will give you all the specifics. Now, if you want something free that you can get right now, you can go to the Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com, and look at the Catholic Encyclopedia online. Go to D for Daniel and go to M for Maccabees, and you can read the article about those two books of the Bible. And there, too, it'll tell you when it was written, who wrote it, what the background details are, and chances are that's going to kind of help you resolve some of these question marks that you've got. I hope that's helpful, Luis. I have to take a break, but I'll be right back right after this. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
We've got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You like it?
You got it.
888-914-9149. Let's go to Sonia in Berkeley, California. Hello, Sonia.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome.
My question, if you could please explain free will to me a little bit more so I can help my friend who we get into a discussion often about free will.
Mm-hmm.
If you can explain that to me.
I'll try. Yeah, the short form answer is this, that God made us out of love. He didn't need us, doesn't need company. He doesn't need entertainment. He doesn't need, you know, some distraction. So the universe and everything in the universe, including angels and human beings, are superfluous to God in a strict sense because he's perfect in himself. He doesn't need anything at all. And yet all these things do exist. So we can reason our way toward a very important truth, and that is that the only adequate reason why God would create these good things that he has created, such as angels and human beings, is out of love. And then because he created us in a way, so let's talk about human beings here, he created us with the capacity to know him, so he is in, to a certain extent, intelligible to us. We can know that he exists. We can know that he's good. We can know that he loves us. And of course, he's revealed that most fully through Jesus Christ, his son. And so we see that he created us not only out of love, but he created us for love. So his desire is that we would not only know him, but that we would also love him. So our capacity to love God in response to his overture to us can only be possible if we are free. Meaning that we would have to have some way of saying yes or no. And if we were completely unfree and unable to say no, then that wouldn't be love. So the foundation, really, of the question of free will, and there's so much that can be said about it, but fundamentally what it means is that God has made us in such a way that we can say yes or no. Now, some people misunderstand this reality, and they mistakenly think that there's some kind of competition between God's sovereignty and our free will, or that they propose a false dichotomy to say it's either 100% God's sovereign will or decree, or it's you, the human creature, and you're doing, you know, all that's necessary by accepting or rejecting, and that's not true either. So God is, in his grace and his sovereign free will, is not in competition with human free will. They're made by God to go together. So in a way, perhaps, that you could think of, to just use an analogy, imagine like a three-masted sailing ship. Well, the wind that's blowing in the sky could be likened to God's will. The ship, when it rigs its sails and furls its sails, it can be carried along by that wind, and it can be guided to its destination by that wind. And so the human being, in a way, is like that three-masted sailing ship. And when you cooperate with God's grace, it's like deploying the sails. And it's not that you're moving yourself to where you need to go. God is the one who's doing it, but you're cooperating with him. And it's because that's how he made you. He made you so that you can say yes or no. But that doesn't mean that his, you know, sovereignty is in competition somehow with your free will. Now, that's a very basic explanation. There's much more that one could say. But does that little explanation shed a little more light on it for you?
I guess the second part of it is that he believes that God, like we all have predetermined path, and that we can't just, he's saying that if we make it, like there's no other way than God's way in our life, and that like God failed. It's saying like God, he says that God's failed if we say like we have free will.
No, it's not true. Yeah, he's misunderstanding it. So he's coming at it from a position, I don't know if he's religious or not. If he's religious, it may be because he's become confused by Calvinism, which, you know, for many people, they think that that's they think that that's the explanation for it, but simply say that human beings don't have any free will at all, in which case then God becomes the author of evil. Because if we did not have any free will, then those who do not believe in God or who do not cooperate with God's grace, it's not even their own fault. It's something God is doing to them, in which case God becomes the author of evil, and that would be contrary to his nature as God. So he's all good. He's not the author of evil, and he won't cause somebody to do something that is contrary to his plan for their happiness. So it is often misunderstood as being kind of a determinism, in that everything you say or do is pre-programmed anyway. And they'll say, because God knows everything, it doesn't really matter what you say or do because, you know, God knows it. And this is another fallacy on that part. And that is to wrongly equate God's foreknowledge of something with his cause of something. So just because God knows exactly what is happening, because for him everything is in the eternal now, he knows everything that can be known. There's nothing that can be known that God doesn't know. But that doesn't mean that he causes those things to happen. So in a similar way, the wind in the sail of the sailing ship, it is causing that sailing ship to move in the direction that the wind is blowing. But that is presuming that the captain of the ship opens the sails up and cooperates with the wind. If he doesn't do that, the wind can blow and the ship's not going to go anywhere. So your friend is operating from a position, it sounds to me, as though no matter what he does, God has already pre-programmed it. And that can't be true, you know, because again, if that is true, then that means that God becomes the author of evil. And we can rule that out because God is all good.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. I'm going to share this information with him and then probably be calling you back.
Yeah, please do.
His response in a future time.
Please do. And he's welcome to call anytime. There's a good book. It's a bit heady, but I think you might find it helpful. It's called Predestination, and it's by a French Dominican. His name is Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. He's since gone on to his eternal reward. But it's published by Tan Books, and it's a biblical overview of free will and how God created us with free will and how we are given by God the capacity to cooperate with that. So that might be a good resource for you. You're welcome. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Tina now in California. Hello, Tina.
Hello. Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Good. I have a problem. And the problem is that my whole life, my family, we were pagans.
Okay.
And one day, out of nowhere, out of the blue, 2 years ago, I jumped out of bed, got cleaned up, and found a Catholic church and went to it. And I had never been to a church before.
Okay.
And something really bad happened to me many years ago. And I thought there was a God and a goddess. And Jesus, I'm not having a hard time with Jesus and his teachings, but I'm having a hard time loving God because of what he allowed to happen to me. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I learned from what happened to me is to stay away from people. And I've stayed away from people for 20 years.
So somebody hurt you a long time ago.
Very badly. I was beat up. It was bad.
Yeah. And how could a loving God allow that to happen? If he really loved you, why would he let that happen?
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't understand why a God that is supposed to take care of us and talk to us and as we pray to him, why would someone say that such a loving God would allow what happened to me happen? Mm-hmm. And so I'm having a hard time accepting God, even though I know God and Jesus are one.
Yeah.
I can't separate them.
No, you shouldn't separate them. You're experiencing in your own life what is commonly called the problem of evil. And it goes something like this. You actually have said part of it. So it goes something like this. You believe in a God that you claim is all-powerful and all-loving, and yet evil exists. So this God you believe in is either not all-powerful because he doesn't have the ability to stop the evil, or he's not all-loving because he doesn't stop the evil. He could, but he doesn't do it. So how can he be all-loving and how can he be all-powerful? In which case, people who kind of reason their way in this direction, many of them conclude that therefore there can't be a God, that there is no God because of the presence of evil in life. Now, I don't know if you have gotten to that point. I hope you haven't. But some people do.
No, I still believe in that there's a God. I'm having trouble understanding understanding his love. And maybe everybody mm-hmm. does that. I don't know. But I have trouble understanding his love because of what he allowed to happen.
Right. And we can think in terms of war and disease and tsunamis and you name it. There's just so many terrible things that take place that are natural and some that are moral because people make bad decisions. And so we see evil all around us. It's everywhere. And it leads us to say, God, why aren't you fixing this? Why did you allow this to happen? Now, I'll share with you what for me was helpful, Tina, and I'll just offer this to you for you to think about. When one of my sons was about 3 years old, he was playing in the front yard and he got hit in the face by something that tore a big gash in his forehead above his eye. Now, my wife and I, we were young parents. We didn't know a whole lot about anything. And so we ran outside and he's screaming and holding his face and there's blood everywhere. And we were terrified. We didn't know what had happened. So we get him in the car, we go to the emergency room. Now, if you can picture the scene, they had put him on a papoose board where they lace up the child so he can't thrash. And so my wife and I are standing there and we're beside ourselves and you know we're crying. He's screaming in pain and he's, as the doctor is washing the wound and putting a needle in there to, you know, to anesthetize it. And it was all the things that were happening to him in the hospital were even more traumatic and painful than the initial accident itself. So the weird thing about it was he's looking at us and he's screaming, you know, Mom, Dad, help me, help me. We're standing there doing nothing. And he's feeling the pain of the needle, he's feeling the pain. Eventually that probably went away, but the suturing, they had to suture up the wound and all that. And he sees his mom and dad, who he thought loved him, standing there doing nothing and allowing him to go through this terrible pain. Now, for me, that was helpful in helping me understand, even though I don't fully understand it, but how an all-loving God who loves you, Tina, he really does love you. It's for us, when we see, why doesn't God fix this? For me, it began to make a little more sense, because I, as an adult, I realized my son, who's there in pain, thinks I'm not doing anything because I don't love him, but I'm allowing him to go through this because I love him and because I don't want there to be a scar. And I know there's pain and there's blood and there's agony, but it's better for me to let the doctor do his work to heal this little boy's injury. And thankfully today, there's not even a scar if you were to see him today. So I wish I could talk more about this. Could you call me again tomorrow, Tina? We'll pick it up from there. It's an important topic, but maybe that's the first step in the right direction. Thank you. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. God bless you.